Chicago-born Liz Phair has been a recording artist and a touring performer for 25 years. She's sold over 5 million records worldwide, 3 US gold albums, 2 Grammy nominations. She's a feminist trailblazer. She's a globally published author, a composer, a visual artist, and now she's returning to the stage soon to tour her next album, Soberish. Soberish is her first collection of new original music in a decade. Exile in Guyville, which was her debut double album, bold, lyrically, sexually frank songs paired with equally inventive and remarkable guitar playing by Phair, has been ranked by Rolling Stone magazine as one of the 500 greatest albums of all time. It's been rated by Pitchfork as one of the 100 greatest albums of the 90s, and it's considered one of the most accomplished debut albums for any artist in any genre to date. 2018, Liz's original label Matador released a fully expanded edition of Phair's original girly sound tapes onto digital service providers for the first time. Fans got excited at being able to hear her original early work, and in 2019, so a year later, Liz released her memoir, Horror Stories, which is very original and absolutely worth your time. She also reunited with her producer Brad Wood, who worked on Exile in Guyville and Whip Smart. That ultimately resulted in them working together on Soberish, which comes over a decade after Liz has released any albums. It's pretty exciting, and Liz and I have that conversation, which I hope you enjoy.
So glad we made this happen.
Well, thank you so much for putting up with our crazy switching schedule.
No, not at all. As Heidi might tell you later or has told you already, I was super keen on me being the one to do this. I didn't kneecap any other journalists, but it did cross my mind. So look, I have a whole list of questions, which I figure I'll just throw at you in our now limited time frame. But I'm also more than open to you saying I want to talk about this or that.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. So I loved your horror stories. And I guess it was very honest about male violence towards women and the blame that's put on women. And I'm wondering how raising a son has given you insight into the way boys and men are raised and perhaps colored the way that you raise your son?
Well, it has given me a lot of insight. I saw the world through his eyes as he became a man, that transition from boyhood to manhood. And I saw the way that it was almost as if this sort of archetypical masculinity came in and snatched my son for a while. You know, there was a real sense of induction into the membership of manhood. And I also saw, which made me sad in a way, like the kind of pressure that men are under in their peer groups, you know, to be a certain way. I think he has a solid foundation because of the way I raised him and his father, but it was eye-opening to see the kinds of things that he had to deal with versus what I dealt with as a young woman.
On another note then, entirely, what does Soberish refer to? Because I have read interviews with you where you say it's not literally necessarily being sober, drugs and alcohol, but
it can be. It can be. There are times when that's exactly what it is. But I think of it, you know, when I decided to title the album Soberish, the song Soberish is about having a couple of drinks when you're nervous and, you know, yet still being functional. I think that's a state that I'm in a lot of the time. I'm always, especially this last year with the pandemic, I definitely, my weed consumption is upticked, but there's a sense that Soberish as an album title refers to the myriad ways that I, and I think a lot of people find ways to escape reality, find ways to soldier on while not taking it right in the face. And it can be anything. Some people work too much, or they, you know, pursue social lives too much, or whatever it is that you're struggling with doing too much or too little of. I think Soberish to me is that street corner. It's like a corner between the you that is, you know, connected to reality and the you that isn't. And I think both are valid and neither should be demonized. It's the way I live my life. And I'm hoping that a lot of people understand and relate to that.
It seems to me it's quite different to Australia at the moment, but it seems to me that I guess I just notice on quite a lot of the Instagram accounts of US people that I follow that there's very much an acceptance of weed now, much more than I would say the 90s or anything like that, when it was demonized as, you know, as it was pretty much seen as bad as the opiates. But it seems now it's almost every day, almost cool to be quite open about cannabis use. I mean, do you feel that there's still stigma attached?
There's only stigma, I feel, generationally. I think that the holdover from a time when weed was demonized or cannabis was considered a frightening drug or something that belonged to the streets, if you will. I've never felt that way. I've always been a fan of the way it made me feel and the kind of thoughts it gave me and the creativity that I felt. I love playing guitar when I'm high because I just flow a little bit more. I'm a little more adventurous and confident, but I would never actually do anything. I can't get anything actually done. You know, like I've never performed on any substance ever. And I can't imagine. Sometimes I wonder what it would be like to be a true rock star and like really go all in, but that's not going to happen for me in my lifetime. I fantasize about it. I think I'd forget all my words, but I do find it gives me a reset and it connects me to sensuality and it connects me to a kind of oceanic feeling of well-being and oneness with the positive natural forces. So I like it a lot.
And speaking of true rock stars, talk to me about Lou Reed. What was your connection with Lou? What inspired that story, that song?
Well, at a basic level, both Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson, his wife, were influential, or I was influenced by their work early on in my career. I took a lot of my girly sound tapes, which were the sort of demos I made before my first record. I took a lot of inspiration from the way that she played with voices and storytelling and sounds, electronica. And Lou Reed with Velvet Underground, I loved his raw do-it-yourself, like not too polished, just kind of from the heart, off the cuff, like it's no big deal, rock and roll. So both of them were these artists I looked to early on in my career. And then when they got married, it triggered the romantic in me. And I thought, like, God, what a relationship. Like, could I ever have a relationship like that? You know, it felt like two titans had come together and they were so sweet with each other. And when we made that song in the studio, it was actually a different song altogether with different lyrics. And I wasn't satisfied with it. I just felt like it wasn't working. And I pulled out my guitar and I pulled out my vocals. And my producer was working on a loop, and there was a little artifact on one of the loops that kind of made a sound that was looping over and over, going, hello, hello, hello. And we started laughing, thinking that it was saying, hey, Lou. And we started riffing on the idea that it's Lori calling to Lou, saying like, hey, Lou. And then we just, it just immediately, some songs just take off like that. It just fell together, I swear, in like half an hour. We just scribbled down all the lyrics and we were laughing. We were like fits of giggles. Like, what must their ordinary life be? Like, what must the ordinary interaction between two legends, two mm-hmm. people that we revere be, you know? So that's sort of where it sprang from.
Yeah, I kind of think perhaps a little bit the same when I was reading Patti Smith's first memoir. And and you know, before you read that memoir, well, oh my God, it's Patti Smith, and you know, she must spend all her time hanging out with Andy Warhol, and like that being cool. And then there's kind of, and she pretty much does, but there are still those moments of making tea with Fred in the kitchen, and you just go, yeah, you're an ordinary person, and you do ordinary things, and I mean, you still do them in a really cool way, but it does. I guess it's a little bit touching. Like your horror stories, it humanizes someone that you've only ever seen two-dimensionally.
Yes, that's a beautifully way to put it. I love that. That's exactly what it is. It's very touching. There's something poignant about it.
Hmm.
You know, it's a way to connect with an artist that feels intimate, I guess.
Well, I think there's a fear, especially in artists, and I would say younger artists starting out more so, that if people see that you are human, well, will they still imagine that you're this big, amazing celebrity? Will they still buy into this brand that your managers have set up that has been highly curated for you? I think it's a really brave thing to, whether it's social media these days or whether it is the way that you did it with writing a book, with the podcast, of just saying, well, yeah, I am human, but I would like you to buy my art because I'm human.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it's something to do with my age, you know, and my experience, the length of time I've been in this career. I've learned something that I could not have known in my 20s, and that is, a concert is actually a collaboration between audience and artist. And I think when I was younger, I thought I needed to deliver this show, and I do, but at the same time, it's their connection to the music that is, you know, how they experience my music. It reminds them of that summer that they were with their boyfriend, or it reminds them that of that trip that they took senior year, or whatever it is. They're bringing all that. So in a weird way, the actual power of the artist is not the separation. It's the coming together over the distance. It's bridging the distance and bringing us together into what truly makes us human and what we aspire to be. You know, an artist on stage aspires to fill the boots that they've set out for themselves. You know, if you think that an artist on stage feels as powerful as they look, you're fooling yourself. You know, they too are reaching for that ideal.
On a related note, I loved the interview that you did with Alanis Morissette for LA Times, and it got me thinking. She's very much come out and been very open with media about. Still performing and the aging process and expectations of female artists, but very much so is Shirley Manson. And I was a massive Garbage fan and love her podcast as well. I mean, do you feel like they really are women that you've known a long time, that you've come up alongside?
I do feel that, and I'm so excited to get to know them both better on the tour, because they're both women that I feel a resonance, I resonate with what they're, and they're different from me. You know, we're all different from each other, but there's some kind of it must have been that era, you know, bringing that forward and still working, still putting out music. We admire each other and we're excited to see each other. And I think we're going to learn from each other. And I do believe that when you have shared experiences and you've trekked through the same forest, you've trekked over the same mountains, you might not have been side by side, but you sure know what that was. And you want to tell the stories, you know, you want to say like, yeah, did you see that bridge? Yeah, I barely got over it. You know what I mean? Like there's a real camaraderie, I think. And I love being at this stage in my career, even for all the stresses of it's a young person's game and, you know, are you on TikTok? You know, how's your following? But it's lovely to be with women that have been through the wars just like you have. And it's like a shorthand. We can communicate easily with each other.
Have the tour dates been confirmed for US, UK and Europe with Alanis and Shirley?
I believe so. We all are watching what happens with reopening. You know, there's no guarantee. We are assuming everything will go ahead as planned. I suspect it will, but there's always that question. I mean, nobody really knows what's happening with COVID.
When is the first show scheduled to go ahead?
I think it's July 31st. So we have a few months to get everybody, you know, but it does go into international territory in the fall. So your guess is as good as mine. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, can we get everybody vaccinated? Will the variants overtake our vaccination? Will the wealthier countries share with the less wealthy countries? I don't know what's going to happen. I watch it daily and I try not to stress out about it.
Can you tell me about media now? I mean, because I guess it's been, what, 11 years since Fun Time, and then I found your first Rolling Stone cover thanks to Google the other day. and I was looking at it, and it was so 90s, the slip dress, the dark lipstick, the everything about it was, because I used to collect all the Rolling Stone covers. I was obsessive. I had them, believe it or not, I made my mum laminate them so I could then stick them
on the table. That's
great. It's so 90s, but I mean, how have things changed now? Would you say that you feel more like you can have an input into how you're presented, or do you just go with whatever they ask you to do?
In some ways it's very different, but it reminds me of that sort of old adage that, like, when one thing starts going well, another thing starts falling apart, you know, like, just because our targets have shifted and we're focusing on different aspects of the career, it doesn't mean it's any easier, because you're still always going to have to learn new skills because the culture has moved to this area, and now everyone's doing things on social media platforms. And how comfortable do you feel doing that? And how well can you fit into that? Is there a place for you? I think a lot of stuff feels better. I think women are treated better. I think there are more of them, more female artists. So I think there's a great deal more understanding of a female artist's needs in the business. We're less isolated. We're less talked down to or bullied. But at the same time, there's a superficiality about it that I didn't have to deal with coming up. You know, when I was growing up and first starting my career, there's a superficiality of all of these presentations that I think must be very hard to decide if you're a young artist, like, how much do I participate? How much do I play against it? In one sense, you want to reach as many people as possible. And in another, I would think it would take a lot of time and money and effort to keep up with that stuff. So I don't know. And I think it's a different landscape in a lot of ways, in some ways much better, and in some ways maybe more challenging than ever. If they make a mistake, it's around forever. You can never forget about it.
With Soberish, I mean, because it was such a long time between albums, at what point did you start thinking what I'm doing here is potentially an album? I mean, were you still playing? Were you still writing all that time, just without the expectation of an album?
I was actually scoring television. I was working in TV as a composer. So I did that for about 6 or 7 years. And that was an interesting skill to learn. I wanted to be, my son's now graduated from college, but when he was in junior high and high school, I didn't want to tour. I wanted to be there for him. I wanted to be around. So I looked for a way to still make music, but not have to go out on the road. And really, you know, in the US, if you make a record, you're expected to tour it. And that's the only way that labels are interested. And that's really the only way that you can make money anymore. So although that's all changing now again because of COVID, I mean, like, it's amazing to watch the business change and change and change. Absolutely. And what's going to happen after this? It's crazy to think about. But right before I made Soberish, we released a box set with my original label Matador of the Girly Sound of Guyville, which is all the sort of cassette tapes I made before I made my first album, and then a remastered version of my first album, Exile in Guyville. Mm-hmm. And going back and like listening to all the old stories and thinking about Wicker Park and where I started out and talking to everybody, I connected again with Brad Wood, who was the producer for Exile in Guyville. And I felt suddenly a kinship to my early career that I hadn't in a while. And I kind of remembered how to be Liz Phair. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it kind of happened that way.
I love that. I actually, I listened to your Song Exploder episode, and I actually recommend it to everyone because it had me laughing out loud when you, when you told the story. Particularly, I mean, several times, let me tell you, but particularly when you told the story about asking your ex-boyfriend what a good album was. would you mind sharing that story again?
No, yeah, it's very funny because I was a visual artist at that point, and I had wanted to be a visual artist, and I had majored in art history and studio art at college, and my whole life I had planned to be a famous visual artist, like a painter or a drawer or something. And I had all these boyfriends that were in bands and they loved music, and they used to make me mixtapes. You know, for the younger generations, they won't know what that's, but it was a romantic gesture that couples would give to each other. They would make a mixtape of all these songs. And I got so tired of men telling me what good music was, and all of them arguing amongst themselves about what good music was and why it was better than this and why it was worse than that. And finally, I just decided, like, really, how hard can it be? And I wanted to make my own record. I'd been writing songs quietly in my bedroom. And I was standing with my boyfriend in my apartment, and I was saying, like, what would be a good learning tool? What should I sort of use as a template for how to make an album? And I'm like, what is the best record ever made? And I reached through this box of cassettes I had, and I pulled out Exile on Main Street, which I really wasn't familiar with. I knew other Stone songs. I'm like, is this a good record? And he just laughed. He's just like snorted very sarcastically, like, yeah, it's like one of the best records. And he's like, why don't you do a double album? As if that would be the most egregious, uppity thing I could possibly do. And I just looked at him and I'm like, well, why don't I? You know, like, and lo and behold, I did. And that was a great album to learn from and sort of respond to and wrestle with in a way and do it my own way.
So you would have said that you weren't familiar with the album prior to just picking it up?
I wasn't. I knew a couple of songs on it, obviously, but no, it was a very immersive. I loved it. It was like a graduate student thesis or something. It was great.
Are you still in touch with that boyfriend?
No, come on. No way. I think that was the end of the relationship right there anyway, you know. Like,
yeah,
I think he was probably really pissed because he either played in bands or I forget hung out with bands, and like for me to come along and actually do it, I think that caused them all a little bit of discomfort.
Totally. Can I ask, how old is your son now, and has he shown any interest in the music industry?
He's 24, and no, he's not interested at all, and he never has been. In fact,
but he's going to be the big visual artist.
Well, he does do that. He does. I mean, here's an interesting thing. I don't know if they sent you the artwork, but he did all the art on my album. So all the artwork on the album was his graphic, you know, his computer graphic art. Yeah, he's very talented.
I had a feeling that he might have that artistic streak as well.
But he definitely distinguishes himself from me. That's sort of a thing with him. It's like, you're you, mm-hmm. I'm me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. In fact, when he was a little kid, I was going to tell you this quick story.
Yes.
I thought when I was pregnant that I would spend all this time with my baby playing guitar, singing songs. I just had this vision of our idyllic life together. And when he was old enough to kind of like, you know, sit up on his own and say a few words, I was strumming guitar toward him, and he put out his hand and he just put it on the guitar and pushed it away. And he said, "No, mommy, no, no."
Oh,
wow. And I was like, oh, well, I guess that's not how this is going to go. No, mommy, no, no.
Oh, that's such a shame.
There goes that plan.
Bohemian ideal.
Right, no.
And so now, I mean, are you, now that you've put out the album, are you still sort of noodling around? Are you working on new things? Do you feel like, maybe there's a streak, or is the focus purely on touring?
Right now I'm writing the follow-up to Horror Stories. I'm writing fairy tales. So I'm writing the other side, the light side of my life and my memories, the more glamorous, exciting rock and roll moments, the bigger sort of the yin and the yang, if you will. So I'm working on that while I'm also promoting Sobresh. So that's sort of how I'm spending my time.
What's the timeline for fairy tales?
I don't know. It got all messed up with pandemic. You know, mm-hmm. I had this great plan, and I did not feel for the last year very cheerful. You know what I mean? That like the feeling I wanted to get into for fairy tales was sort of the bright and the big and the bold and the good. And that's not at all how I felt. So I lost a year in a way of work time. I had the time to do it, but not the headspace. I felt afraid and angry and mistrustful and tired, you know?
Yeah.
You really have handled COVID so much better than the US has. So it's a very different, it must be hard to understand how we are messing it up this badly, although Biden is now fixing it, but like it really was a very unsure, nothing felt secure, nothing at all in the country felt secure over the last year. It was a very tough year.
Yeah, look, I guess Australian media has always treated the US like, I guess like a celebrity, like come in and take over our news. We want to talk all about you. So, and I guess it was hard to avoid Trump. I mean, he was so outrageous that, I mean, he was better than soap opera. He was better than,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was better than a natural disaster. He was just constant 24/7 entertainment. I think Australian media went, we can't report local stuff. We just got to put Trump on. So in a way, absolutely, we viewed it from the outside.
I'm so sorry that he spread that far.
Oh, well, how could he not? we're very much viewed from the outside, but still it was very evident from the beginning that that things were going to get worse and worse over there well before they got better.
And culminating in the January 6th insurrection, which was one of the most shocking things that's ever happened in my life to see. And that, I mean, there's a lot that America has to reckon with. We have to, there's a lot to be done. It's a, not a great, I mean, I've enjoyed a pretty good life in the US for a while, but it is daunting, you know, the things that we need to fix and deal with. I mean, it's daunting. Where do you want to turn? You have a problem, you know?
Have you ever considered living elsewhere?
Oh, yes. Many, 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 many times. it's, as my son will say, he's like, Mom, there's stuff going on. This is sort of a cataclysm, I think, for the whole world as we grapple with globalism. I think we're all going through something that is turbulent because we're realizing that we have to change systems and come into a more global perspective. And I think that there's upheaval everywhere in different ways. So as much as it's a fantasy to just like immediately move, because, oh my God, did I have fun in Australia? I guess it was 2018 or maybe it was 2019. I can't remember. But it was so beautiful. I'm like, I could live in Sydney. Of course I could, you know, like, Golden Plains. Wow. Just heaven. I mean, there was so much to love about so many countries that I traveled to, and I fantasize about it all the time and actually make inquiries and stuff about living different places. But you know, the adage, like your troubles will follow you. I'm not sure. And also there's a sense of, I don't want to just jump ship. Like, Biden gives me hope. I feel like we are going to do some things that we've been putting off in as relates to our culture, our society, the infrastructure, our economy. Let's give it a chance. But yeah, I think about it all the time.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I went to Barcelona a couple of years ago and was certain that I could live there. And it's funny because I think as an outsider, you get a different idea of a place. And it wasn't till I was going back to the airport and the taxi driver went, there are no jobs here. None of the young people here are working. No one can afford to rent. And it's funny because I'd walked around in my touristy, I guess, days going, oh, everything's beautiful. And people hang out with their guitar at the beach. And you don't see all the people who are not affording to go hang out at the beach.
Yeah, I really think that we are going through as a planet. I think we are, as a human society, we are going through a transition, which is, and I hope that climate is what's going to bring us all together. That's my hope.
Liz, thank you enormously for taking the time to be interviewed. And I love the album. I loved Exile as well, so it feels like full circle to me, and I can't wait for Fairy Stories to come out. Is that coming out through the same publishers?
Yes, through Random House.
Great. I'll chase
and thank them. You for thank you for doing so much research and for giving me such interesting things to think about. I really appreciate that. That was above and beyond.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you, and good luck with the rest of the interviews. I will be laminating the next real life cover that you do. I'll have to go dust off that laminating machine and see if my mother can operate it as efficiently as used to.
Put her back to work.
Exactly.
And then bring her to the concert. All right. Thank you.
I will
so
do.
Much.
Thanks, Liz.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. See right through.
Liz Phair's Soberish is out via Chrysalis Records on June the 4th. The theme music for this podcast is Dark Sea by Eva and Ella Menopi.